Our next storyteller is Asif Majid, and he's an interdisciplinary musical and theatrical artist and a wonderful guy. He was brought to us by our intern and assistant producer, Brooke Savage, who's actually in one of his classes at UMBC, and she said he's a wonderful teacher. But he didn't want me to tell her how young he is, but Brooke, he's 24. One thing I want to say, you know, over these 10 years, one of my favorite things about doing the Stoop is really wrestling with stories, with the storytellers. And Asif was so game to do this, and we spent what was for me a very pleasurable hour or more over these on the phone this past week, just like going over his story again and thinking about what it was really about. And anyway, I feel like what you see here on stage is the culmination of a long process, and the process has been so revelatory for me, I know for Jessica, and hopefully for the storytellers. And it's always just terrific when someone dives into it like Asif. So please welcome him.
So when I was 15 years old, my family, my parents and my sister and I, decided that it was time for us to go for Hajj. For those who don't know, Hajj is a required pilgrimage that is required once in your lifetime for all Muslims. There's a lot of rules associated with it because it's a ritual of self-purification. But for us, it was something more than that. It was really about the spirit of going and being engaged and being in the space and really having an opportunity for us to know what it means to be a part of something bigger. So we made our way to Saudi Arabia, which is where Hajj happens, outside of Mecca. And one of the rituals that's there, this was on the second day in the tent city of Mina. 100-degree Saudi heat, which is amazing. If you've ever gone through it, it's awesome. We go to the first ritual of the morning on the second day, which is called the Jamarat. Now, the Jamarat is basically where you take a bunch of little stones, imagine some pebbles that you've picked up on the side of the road, and you chuck them at these massive 25-meter by 25-meter walls. And the point of it is to whittle away at any sort of vice that you have, something that you want to improve about yourself. For me, at that age, I had a bit of a potty mouth. So the thing that I particularly wanted to focus on was not having a potty mouth. So I was throwing my stones, and it was really great after having been there early in the morning. And like I said, with my sister and my parents, and we had all decided on a meetup point, a place where we were going to meet after we were done with our individual rituals. There's, 3.5 million people hanging around that year. You might get lost. It could happen. So we decided to get to our meetup point, I was the first one finished, and I got to the meetup point, and I kept walking. And I don't know why. To this day, some, thanks, Laura, 10 years later, I still don't know why I kept walking and why I didn't just wait for my parents and my sister. But I did. I kept walking, and as I walked, I knew that the place that I needed to go to, which is our tent where we were staying, was next to the Qurbani. And the Qurbani is another one of the rituals of Hajj, and it basically involves sacrificing an animal, a la Abraham, from that whole biblical thing. In that time, I started to realize, well, I should probably ask somebody. So one of the first people I ran into was a police officer, and Saudi police officers, great folks. I decided to ask him. I said, excuse me, do you speak English? And he said, no. And I thought, well, this is going to go really well. I was a little bit peeved, about that. But the thing, one of the rules of being in the state of ihram, which is what you are in when you go for Hajj, is that you have to control your emotions. So I couldn't really, lash out at the guy in any way, shape, or form. So I kept walking. I asked a number of other people and said, well, do you know where the Qurbani is? Can you show me how to get there? And the resounding message that came back was that I needed to take a taxi. which is really awkward because I didn't take a taxi to get where I started, so I'm kind of curious about how this happened. But the other thing about it is that when you're in the state of Ihram, another one of the rules is that you can't go under covered transport during the day. And so what I mean by this is you can't, for instance, you know, sit inside a bus and go somewhere. You can't sit inside a truck, can't sit inside a car, a taxi. You could sit on a bus, you could sit on a truck, or you could sit on a motorcycle. I'm 15, just saying. So I decide that, okay, well, a lot of these people are telling me that I need to get onto some type of transportation to take me to this Qurbani. Okay. And I run into these two folks who have a motorcycle, and I say, ask if they could take me to the Qurbani. And they agree, and we settle on a price, haggling. It's a Saudi thing. I get onto the motorcycle. Now, it's at this point that you should also know that being in the state of Ihram requires that you, as a male, are wearing a certain garb. And the certain garb, imagine if there's a male in your life who you know that after they take a shower, they wrap a towel around their business end of things. So imagine that. So that's half of it. And the other half of it is if they were to also take a similar towel-esque garment and wrap it around the top half of their body, kind of, you know, like as if they're a Roman warrior or something like that, you know, kind of messenger bag style. And that's it. So let that sink in. That's it. Okay? So that's it. I just want to be clear about that. And these are two unstitched white pieces of cloth. They are the thickest, least breathable white pieces of cloth I've ever worn in my entire life. And so I'm sitting on the back of this motorcycle wearing these two unstitched white pieces of cloth. And we make our way, somebody's laughing, amazing. And we make our way down, you know, a series of highways and to this particular place where there's a bunch of sand. It's Saudi Arabia, 100-degree heat, bunch of sand, and they're doing some of the animal slaughtering there, and I see no tents. And I'm like, this is totally not Kansas anymore. Need to figure something out here. And so I decide to hail another motorcycle and go back in the other direction. Knowing, of course, that the only thing that I had that was in my head was that I had been at the Jamarat that whole morning, so that's the thing that I remember last. So I hail another motorcycle, same, nothing, wearing, happening. And I decide, you know, to get back on this motorcycle, and this guy was a gem of a character. He didn't stop at any red lights. And in addition to not stopping at the red lights, he drove through them or rode through them and proceeded to yell at the other drivers who were respecting the laws of the traffic and basically, in so many Arabic words, flipped them off with this random 15-year-old kid wearing two unstitched white pieces of cloth and, in case it wasn't clear, no underwear. On the back of a motorcycle. The one light that he did choose to stop at, we're sitting there at the light, and we're maybe now 10 minutes from where the Jamarat is, and we finally figured it out after this whole kind of morning journey. And there's a guy on the side of the road, 100-degree heat once again, and he's handing out bottles of water, kind of as if it's like, you know, some stadium event, you know, DC United's playing or something, I don't know. And he so hands out these bottles of water. He gives one to the motorcycle driver. He gives one to me. I'm like, great, okay, water, go team. Let's move it along here. And then the motorcycle driver, maybe to make up for the fact that he didn't stop at any red lights, tells the guy with the water, no, he's a haji. Give him more. So the guy proceeds to give me two more bottles of water, which I stuck into a bag that I had been carrying some point in the journey. I had bought some cookies and mango juice. I was 15. I was hungry. It's life. And so I'm carrying this bag of cookies and mango juice with my two unstitched white pieces of cloth that I'm wearing on the back of a motorcycle. And we get to the Jamarat, and I get off and I pay the man and I start walking back in the direction. I've kind of figured out, okay, this is where I need to go, not where I came from. And in the time that I started walking, it's maybe getting to around, you know, 11 or 12 in the morning, So it's quite hot. It's really hitting the 100, 110 degree heat. And there's this older guy among thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people who were thronging back from the Jamarat and making their way back to the tents. And he comes up to me, and I don't know how he knew. It still boggles my mind. I don't know how he knew this, but he came up to me and he goes, "Do you have any water?" And I'm like, "Are you shitting me? Oh, wait, I can't curse. I'm in the state of Ephraim. I have to control myself." I was like, "What do I have, like, this big tattoo on my forehead that must say, like, 'water sold here,' you know, like something like this?" And so I go and I'm like, "Yeah, yes, please take one." And he wanders away looking thrilled as if I've like, you know, like, it's the gospel or something. I don't know. And so I proceed to walk, and you know, another 15, 20 minutes go down, and I'm still walking, and somebody else comes up to me and asks me if I have a bottle of water. And at this point, I'm like, okay, they're clearly, like, maybe it's not two unstitched white pieces of cloth. Maybe there's, like, a water sign. I've got, like, a Nestle logo on the back. I'm, like, advertising for Dasani as I'm going. I don't understand. And so I give him a bottle of water. Between that point and the point when I finally made my way back to the tent, not a single other person asked me for water. And the only explanation that I can come up with for the fact that I made that decision at that moment way back in the beginning of the at the Jamarat to not wait for my family is that I had this purpose to be in a position to give these two people water. Among tens of thousands of people, among millions of people who were going for Hajj at that time, I was there for these two people. Now, it's a cliche, and you might be thinking that's a whole lot of hooey, that things happen for a reason. But I can't find any other reason behind this situation, behind this happening, other than to say that when I was put in the situation of making a decision, there was something that compelled me, something that pushed me in a direction to say, I'm not waiting. I'm just going to go. And the reason that I went only became clear 5 or 6 hours later with two bottles of water, mango juice, and some cookies. Thank you very much.